This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
There's this thing that's going on that is disconnected from these big Trump moves. You know, they keep these five stocks doing well, and keeping those five stocks doing well means that even if the other stocks did go down a bunch, that it, how much it would impact the headline numbers. Like, they can keep the stock market green, and at a certain psychological level, that number popping up with, like, Dow or S&P 500, and that number being green rather than red tells me, oh, how bad could things really be?
This week on Sea Change Radio, the second half of our discussion with journalist Nathan Tankus, as we continue to try to get a better grip on what's happening at the Federal Reserve Bank. To quote a recent piece by former U.S. Secretary of Labor Robert Reich, control over the Fed gives Trump more tools for extortion. With control over interest rates, he can get America's biggest corporations and the world's biggest nations to bend to his will. In this part of the conversation with Tankus, we talk a bit more about the attempted firing of Federal Reserve Board Governor Lisa Cook, the historical importance of the Fed's independence, and ponder why Wall Street continues to shrug off all of this unsettling economic news. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Nathan Tankus. He is an author, a journalist, and the president of Notes on the Crises. Nathan, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Operating under the assumption that Lisa Cook is being targeted because she's a black woman, what is the power play that Trump is trying to orchestrate? I saw on Tuesday, August 26th, that Scott Bessent, the Secretary of Treasury, had a fairly disciplined interview where he said, you know, the Fed is going to remain an independent body and we need to just work past this, blah, blah, blah. And then within an hour, Trump had another quote where he was like, I almost have a full majority in the Federal Reserve Board. And the president should not have this power. It's outlined in that Humphreys case that you're talking about. Why is he trying to tip the scales beyond the obvious racial element and sexism? I mean, Lisa Cook is not just a black woman. She's a very powerful black woman. That really upsets him as well, obviously.
Yes, that's clear. It's not just a black woman in general. It's about someone who's powerful, who gained a respect that she, quote unquote, shouldn't have and needs to be humiliated and put it back into her place. The larger politics of this is, you know, this is the one institution that the Supreme Court said, you know, well, you got to work a little harder to get control of this. You know, Trump, as we were just talking about, is a real estate guy. He's a real estate developer. Trump is a man who got big by taking out high interest rates loans in a high interest rate.
First, he got big by inheriting his father's real estate empire.
Yes, he inherited from his father. But in terms of the empire that he built on his own, quote unquote, on his own, you know, using his father's political connections and so on, was by taking out high interest loans, buying lots of property very rapidly during a property boom, such that the value of his property could go up faster than the interest rates on his loans, even when the properties weren't making cash flow. I mean, it, you know, normally it's crazy when you own a casino to buy another casino in the same place, you know, Atlantic City, because those are competing entities. You know, one success is, you know, supposed to draw from another, but he didn't care because he just wanted something that would give him cash now, that would get him a loan, that would get him the benefit of larger capital gains. And, you know, towards the end stage of this process, the Federal Reserve was raising interest rates, and it did not cut interest rates in 1990. And so I guarantee you that Trump has never forgotten that. You know, if they had cut interest rates in 88, 89, 90, rather than raising them and keeping them high, it would have been a bonanza for him, and he might not have ever gone bankrupt. You know, of course, he made all those crazy financial decisions that led him to there, but I'm sure in his mind, at some level, he thinks if the Fed had cut, yeah, he got screwed by the Fed, and that if it had lowered interest rates, he would have never been in any of those situations. And it's probably the last time he formed a cogent thought about economic policy.
His little Scooby-Doo moment where, if it weren't for you meddling kids, I would have gotten away with it.
Exactly. And so he, you know, to a real estate developer, real estate is a very unique industry that relies on lots of leverage, where essentially interest costs is just a large percentage of your overall cost, which is unique. That's not true about most sectors. Basically, it's like oil and gas and real estate are what that's true. So he has a bone deep real estate developer instinct that lower interest rates are better, and I don't think it really goes beyond that. I think he fundamentally in his bones feels lower interest rates are better because they were make and break in the specific industry that he operated in and known his whole life, and that's all he's thinking about, is things will be better, and things will like me better, people will like me better, if interest rates are lower, I want them lower.
So we've gone through the historical context of what the Federal Reserve is. We haven't really talked about how it influences markets. The federal funds rate is set by the Federal Reserve, and any kind of cuts, or even the hint of a cut to the federal funds rate, tends to stimulate the stock market. And we've seen Wall Street be very reactive just now to the most recent hint that there's a quarter point rate cut coming. All of a sudden, that was like a 400 or 500 point spike for the Dow that day. So anybody who has been studying the economy over the last 20 years knows that it's important to differentiate the economy from the stock market. But how has the media fallen short in clarifying this to the public, and how is this being exploited by the current administration?
Well, I would just generally say that for the last 30 years at least, the stock market, and not just the stock market, but the daily movements of the stock market, has been marketed as something that's important to everyday Americans and is important to America's overall well-being. And so it's been kind of constructed as this lever to push. It's been constructed as this thing where, like, if you want people to believe things aren't going bad, you want this number not to go down. And if you want people to believe that things are good, you want this number to go up. And, you know, at a certain level, it's basic and simple. You know, America is the wealthiest country in the world. America has trillions and trillions of dollars of wealth, of financial assets. It's got, you know, tons of billionaires, and there is, you know, and there's generally, we have a culture that is focused on financial gain. We're a country that has legalized gambling on your phone in multiple different respects. There's the actual gambling, there's the sports, you know, the sports betting, there's the crypto, there's all this. And, you know, when you create a society that functions like that, other values like the rule of law, like justice, like, you know, people getting recompense for their rights being violated, you know, protection of the weak, these other values are not. There's not a, you know, little number on the screen that is in red or green on whether those things are doing better or doing worse. And so if you want to make it so that millions of relatively comfortable, or even not that comfortable, but disengaged people believe that well, maybe some bad things are happening, but it's not a crisis. You got to try to get that number to, you know, not go down or go green. And at the same time, well, what does that number represent? You know, ultimately, that number represents the aggregated conventional wisdom of, you know, a relatively small idiosyncratic group of stock market traders. You know, these were people who believed that Trump would be better for the stock market than a second Biden administration or a Kamala Harris administration. An idea that after the last 7 months of chaos, which was not an unpredictable, surprising thing, certainly not to me, certainly not to a lot of other people, they believed that that would be better, that Trump would be better for the stock market. And, you know, you kind of have to imagine what is the worldview of the majority or the vast majority of the participants in that game, in those trades, that they could believe a thing like that. And so you have, you know, kind of a garbage in, garbage out system where you have a bunch of financial traders who are on Twitter, which is, you know, Elon Musk's, you know, fascist hellscape, you might want to, you know, just forthrightly say. People who watch Fox News, some who, God forbid, maybe even watch Newsmax, and you get what those type of people, and or even if they just watch CNBC, and you get those type of people who are feeding into the stock market the conventional beliefs that they're seeing on the news channels that aren't focused on the collapse of the rule of law, aren't focused on the destruction of all sorts of good governance protections, aren't focused on the, like, you know, the damage that is being done to our supply chains by Trump's tariff chaos and so on. And so you get a system that we've designed a system that is supposed to be, or that is where people's attention are focused on. Their people's attention are drawn to this as the main barometer if things are going well and going badly. And then the people who are constructing that barometer, the people who make that barometer move, the people who move the mercury, as it were, are people who are not invested in the principles of democracy and rule of law and justice that we might think are actually higher priorities rather than, you know, quarterly earnings and so on. And this is the result. You get, you know, a result of some absolutely outrageous, extremely alarming things happen, and the stock market more or less shrugs, outside of few notable exceptions, but essentially shrugs. Dear Lord, give me strength to carry on.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Nathan Tankus. He is a journalist, author, and president of Notes on the Crises. So, Nathan, the shrugging you're referring to most recently was when Trump was first laying out his tariff plan and just changing his mind on a daily basis. And just, these were trillions of dollars of global monetary funds that were going to be affected. The whole global economy was basically on tenterhooks as this guy just started spouting off his quote-unquote plans. And the market freaked out for a few weeks. The Dow, for example, went from 45,000 to like 39,000, but now it's back at its all-time high. It's over 45,000. Like, they just shrugged it off and they were like, business as usual. Let's get back to the growth mindset.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think one thing that's important to note is that there's the stock market and then there's the stock market indices. So the fact that there's one number that you can look at, oh, the Standard & Poor's 500 is up or down, or the Dow is up or down, you know, someone has to construct that index and make it become one number. And the problem with these indices that, you know, that get reduced down to one number is it means that the stocks that are the largest proportion of these indices disproportionately impact their behaviors, especially when they're going up, because they go up, they become a larger part of the index, which, you know, and then they go up more, which makes the index number go up. And this matters because these indices are very dominated by the tech sectors. There's basically five tech stocks that are like, I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but are like 41% of the index. And so what that means is that even for the things that Trump does impact, like, you know, specific type of suppliers, you know, specific, you know, things in, you know, cargo or whatever, you know, things that are especially impacted, that are especially about trade, because those are, you know, relatively small parts of the stock market, the negative impact on them doesn't have much of an impact. Even if, say, the fact that its stock price goes down 20 or 30% could potentially mean cataclysmic things on the Americans, because that company, you know, falling apart or being in bad times can signal larger things like, you know, your groceries or other, you know, other essentials that you buy are going to be, you know, cost 20 or 30% more because of tariffs, or you might not even be able to get certain items. You know, that stuff is sort of washed out by the dominance of a few stocks, especially these tech stocks. And of course, you know, the other big kind of the main non-Trump economic story is, you know, so-called AI, so-called artificial intelligence, and the hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars that these largest tech companies are spending on building out data centers and research and development and so on. And so this actually matters to the politics, because since we have this AI boom, some people call it AI bubble, regardless of what you of what you judge the AI craze itself, it means that there's this thing that's going on that is disconnected from these big Trump moves, you know, that keep these five stocks doing well, and keeping those five stocks doing well means that even if the other stocks did go down a bunch, that it, how much it would impact the headline numbers. Like, they can keep the stock market green, and at a certain psychological level, that number popping up with, like, Dow or S&P 500, and that number being green rather than red tells me, oh, how bad could things really be?
Especially to somebody like Trump, who's ADD and has a very fleeting concept of how economics works. So he looks on Fox News and he sees that little ticker like you're talking about, and that's all he needs to know. That's all in his mind. That's all he needs to know.
Especially because Fox News stops publishing the ticker when it's doing real bad. Like, at the worst part of the tariffs in April, they just stop publishing the ticker. Especially for people like Trump and a lot of the people who are watching Fox News or whatever, if you only see the numbers green when it's green and you never see the number when it's red or when it's really red, then that especially creates the psychological effect of, well, it's just going up forever.
Yes. And so people should keep in mind that over the last 40, 50 years, in the growth of mutual funds, is that individual investing has kind of gone by the wayside. People are mostly picking fund managers, and these fund managers are determining where large assets are being bundled, like you were talking about with these tech stocks. I don't know if you're familiar with the Four Pillars of Investing book by William Bernstein.
Yeah, I'm familiar.
So one of his basic tenets is just stay the course and don't let political noise affect your strategy, which should be passive investors, and the market will just keep going up. Just basically don't sweat the small stuff. That's been embraced a lot by brokers who are telling this to potential investors, you know, just stay the course. You know, Trump's talking about the tariffs, but in the long run, you're better off in equities. But in the same course, they're starved for this short-term dopamine hit from the Federal Reserve cutting the federal funds rate a quarter percentage point, and then all of a sudden the market goes nuts. And similarly, having shockwaves affect the market like these tariff announcements. So they're looking at things from a short-term perspective when it suits them and a long-term perspective when it suits them. But basically, they always want people to just keep investing money in this market. That seems to be at odds with each other, those two concepts. Like, are we looking at things through a short-term lens, or are we able to step away and say, is this madness, or is this economy standing on solid footing?
Yeah, I think what you're driving at is a fundamental contradiction in this whole area, where the idea being that, like, we want you to make sure that your quarterly earnings are always good, and you got to always constantly keep your eye on the stock price, and that always has to be front in mind.
From, like, a CEO's perspective,
from a
right?
CEO's perspective, and, you know, if you take, you know, an investment project that might take even just 5 years to pay off, you're going to get punished because 5 years is way too long a timescale. At the same time, especially the trend the last 30 years has been, well, don't try to, you know, mess with things too much. Pick things that will have long-term value. Pick things that, you know, will do well and ride out the short term. Superficially, you know, on its face, you would think, well, if the good thing is to pick stocks of long-term value and to ride out the wave and not get too caught up in short-term behaviors, shouldn't that be a marriage made in heaven? You have the long-term value-picking investor meeting up with the long-term value-oriented CEO executive who is focused on getting long-term returns and making larger strategic decisions. I would say, yeah, I mean, it is a fundamental contradiction. And the way that this circle is squared is essentially through taking companies private and private equity. And the idea of, well, if you really want to be making long-term decisions, you've got to just not be trading on the stock market at all. And I think it's no coincidence that there has been this increasing move to taking companies private. And now we have more and more, we have very large companies that are run privately, and more a move to the extent that you try to sell equity to investors, try to avoid public markets that have SEC disclosure laws. And hey, if you don't have to report your quarterly earnings, then your quarterly earnings are not going to impact the valuations. In fact, that's a big attraction of private equity itself to, for example, pension funds, has precisely been their very illiquidity. The fact that their value, their paper value, doesn't change very often, because if I buy into private equity at, say, 7%, and I say, you know, and I say, well, they're going to give us a 10% return, and you can't really cleanly check on that every year, or the extent you check on it, you basically have to take what they say the value of the things that you're invested in is, then you get to go, well, 10%, you know, 10% returns are going on, and thus, we don't need more money from, say, a local government or a state government to cover these pension obligations or to fully, quote unquote, fully fund this pension, which means having assets on hand to pay pension benefits for 75 years. It's a way of, it greases the wheels all the way down. So in a certain sense, it is a fundamental contradiction. And the way that the people have been resolving this contradiction is to just dissolve public accountability and regulatory accountability that having public markets and a public stock market is supposed to provide.
So why is the Dow so high, Nathan?
Stock traders are not a group where climate scientists are well represented. Stock market is not a group that legal scholars are well represented. It's not a group where people from, you know, human rights nonprofits, civil liberties nonprofits, and it's just sort of fundamental level. All of the huge, the tremendous risks that I'm concerned about, the tremendous risks that you're talking about, the dissolutions that we're discussing, the people trading stocks are not the people who think about that stuff or are affected by that stuff. And so they don't value it. And if they do, are personally concerned, their assumption is that other people don't value it, you know, because the stock market, it, you know, it's the term I like to use is that it's a conventional wisdom processor. And it's not a conventional wisdom processor for all of us. It's about the conventional wisdom of the people that you know are participating. And even if someone's personally concerned about all of these issues, their presumption is going to be that the majority or the vast majority of their colleagues are not concerned. You know, another way to put this is the stock market, you know, in Germany in the 30s went on a tear in the mid to late 30s to, say, the early 40s. And, you know, not to put the most, to put the most kind of crude and sharp point of view on it, German stock market traders in the late 30s and early 40s were not well represented with Jews. So, you know, if you're Jewish, German Jew in the late 1930s, you might think apocalypse is on the horizon, but you're not part of the conventional wisdom of late 1930s German stock market traders. And while that's particularly sharp, an extreme example, I think it's illustrative of the more general point that this conventional wisdom is of a very particular set of people, a very particular set of people with a very particular set of beliefs, and they're not represented of the wider society or the judgments that politically engaged left-wing, even left-of-center people would generally conclude.
Well, it's a very interesting topic, and you've been covering it like no other. I highly recommend our listeners go to Notes on the Crises, or crisesnotes.com. Nathan Tankus, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Miles Davis and Eric Clapton. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.